Welcome to the History Podcast, an educational podcast intended to engage student learning and also engage those history fans who just love American history. Without further delay, let's get to it. Welcome to the podcast. We left off last episode talking about American entrance into World War II. And we talked about how FDR's hands were completely tied early on in the war due to neutrality acts passed by Congress. And each year, FDR was trying to find ways to help our allies in different ways without necessarily sending troops into combat. We talked about the cash and carry provision, which allowed any ship to come and, or any country rather, to come in and get supplies. They just had to bring their own ships and they had to pay cash. We also talked about the Lend-Lease Act, which would eventually be passed in the early years of the war, right as Britain was being invaded by the Germans, and how this bill essentially prevents Hitler from taking over Western Europe. It really, in my estimation, is a turning point in the war. That single piece of legislation prevents Great Britain from falling to the Germans. And it also forces Hitler to make a decision, a poor decision on his part, by invading southern Russia, opening up a second front in the war, and eventually bringing about his downfall. We closed the episode by discussing about Pearl Harbor. December 7th, 1941, the Empire of Japan, who is frustrated by the oil embargo we have placed on them, invades on a surprise attack Pearl Harbor, an island, or the island of Hawaii, rather. This catches the United States off guard. 2,300 Americans killed. And the United States of America no longer feels as if we can stay out of this conflict. FDR calls on Congress to vote for war, and that's where we left off. Congress overwhelmingly votes for war, and on December 8th, 1941, FDR will declare war on Germany and the Empire of Japan and Italy. We're going to spend today's episode talking about multiple things that take place during World War II that deal with the office of the president. But right out of the gate, because of the events at Pearl Harbor, our attention is on the Empire of Japan. And there is a response to Pearl Harbor that festers and grows, and that is this rising sense of nativism that is occurring. And many people within the circle, the inner circle of FDR, are encouraging him to address the Japanese Americans living in the United States as of 1941. And FDR is going to issue Executive Order 9066, as we call it historically, which will authorize the internment of tens of thousands of American citizens who just happen to be of Japanese ancestry, as well as resident aliens from Japan, those over here on work programs. It also gave the military broad powers to ban any citizen from a 50 to 60 mile radius on the West Coast, stretching from Washington State to California, all the way down into southern Arizona. The Japanese prisoners, who the government said were going to relocation camps, would then be transported by the military to their designated relocation camp. We'll also hear the term internment camp, but what they really are concentration camps by definition. And concentration camps are locations where people are forced to live in a close area without their consent. We don't like to talk about this as a concentration camp because we associate, as Americans, we associate concentration camps as death camps, i.e. The Jewish people in Auschwitz, Poland. But make no mistake about it, this is a concentration camp. It's not a death camp, but it's certainly a concentration camp. The hatred for the Japanese is at a high level. And you can see photos, if you're interested in looking this kind of stuff up, you can see photos that bear that out. The Japanese Americans were not wanted in the country after December 7th. They were seen as a threat. They were seen as the enemy. Many of these Japanese Americans were born here. But because they have Japanese ancestry, they are seen as a threat, as the enemy. There were also German and Italian internment camps. They were far less and far smaller, but nonetheless, there still were German and Italian internment camps in the United States. But the Japanese Americans were treated far worse than the Germans and the Italians simply because of Pearl Harbor. Many of these families had their whole entire lives uprooted, forced to sell their homes that they would never return to give up their jobs that they would never return to. Their children were pulled out of their elementary schools, never to return. Entire Japanese American communities were completely ruined. And they weren't just targeting Japanese Americans, they were also targeting resident aliens. Many Americans who are of Japanese ancestry have a major problem with this for obvious reasons. They feel like their rights as American citizens are being violated, that they're being discriminated against simply because they're Japanese, that the government has no evidence to support what they are assuming. And one man in particular by the name of Fred Korematsu is going to challenge this in the court system. This famous case known as Korematsu v. the United States will challenge whether or not Executive Order 9066 is constitutional. And the courts are going to rule that the executive order should be upheld. And they ruled that, and this is their words, not mine, martial necessity arising from the danger of espionage and sabotage warranted this executive order and thus warranted the military's evacuation order. This will be one of the biggest black eyes on FDR's legacy. We've already talked about FDR's court packing scandal. Many in the country feel like FDR felt like he was larger than life, that he didn't have to answer to the Constitution. However, this was one that most Americans supported at the time, Executive Order 9066. Americans were seeing red, they were seeing blood, because they wanted revenge on the Empire of Japan. And so rounding up and essentially locking up Japanese Americans didn't seem all that bad to many Americans at that time. As we look back on it, this is one of the worst moments of FDR's administration. And what's even sadder to me is that the United States will never issue a formal apology for Executive Order 9066 and the ensuing internment of Japanese Americans until the Reagan administration in the 1980s. The discrimination of Japanese Americans after the attacks on Pearl Harbor are very real. But there's also another concern. It's not just the Japanese, it's also a man by the name of Adolf Hitler. On August 2nd, 1939, Albert Einstein, a famous Jewish German scientist, is going to write a letter to the President of the United States, where he'll discuss the possibility of an atomic bomb, fearing that Hitler was very close to having the ability to build atomic weapons, and he urged the President of the United States to stop Hitler before it was too late. The problem was, in 1939, FDR's hands were completely tied by Congress's neutrality acts, and quite frankly, FDR had other things on his mind, including, but not limited to, the Great Depression. And so FDR did not immediately react as strongly as Einstein and other prominent Jewish scientists who had exiled out of Germany once Hitler took over in 1933 had wanted him to do. But what Roosevelt will do is he's going to create the President's Advisory Committee on Uranium. And he does this the day after he gets the letter on August 2nd. He will create the committee on August 3rd. And this is simply just to explore the potential, if you will, of atomic energy. He wants to know, is it possible for us to use atomic energy to build a nuclear weapon? On June 28, 1941, FDR is going to establish the Office of Scientific Research and Development to coordinate the U.S. scientific effort. This would include radar, proximity fuse, sonar, and the atomic bomb, all technologies that we would end up using in some capacity. The development of this bomb was transferred later to the Army under a code name, the Manhattan Project. Now, this project is going to be top secret, and nobody knows really what is going on except for those high-ranking officials within the Manhattan District Project. Even the employees aren't really sure what they are doing. They're working on one part of the bomb, but they don't really know what the big picture really is. And I think one of the things that we need to kind of point out is what we've already kind of alluded to, and that is the bomb was originally built in the event that they might have to use it against Adolf Hitler, which we never had to do. We will end up using it on the Empire of Japan in 1945, but originally the bomb was constructed with the idea in mind, kind of like Einstein believed, that you would end up having to use it on Hitler. But after Hitler opens up a second front with the Soviets, his days are numbered. The United States is going to be fighting this war in two different theaters, as we call it historically. They're going to fight in the European theater, and they're going to be fighting the Japanese in the Pacific theater. And I kind of want to approach this today by starting with the Pacific theater. And quite frankly, in both theaters early on in the war, we are learning real quickly that this is not going to be as easy as we would have hoped it would be. In the Pacific, in the early parts of our involvement, 1942, Japan takes the Philippine Islands. Now, if you remember from our previous podcast, we acquired the Philippines for $20 million way back in the Spanish-American War. And the Filipino people did not want our money. They didn't want our presence there. And we ended up fighting them from 1898 to 1915 in several different skirmishes trying to acquire that territory by force. But it has been ours since that time period. But in 1942, the Japanese will take the Philippine Islands from us, and it is going to be very ugly. They will force our surrender, and will force those left behind to go on a death march, historically known as the Bataan Death March, where they will march several miles in the heat with no food, no water, If you showed any sign of weakness, they would just shoot you dead. And what you have to understand about the Japanese soldier is they view surrender as cowardice. Becoming a prisoner of war is not an option for a Japanese soldier. You better fight to the death. And so when we have U.S. soldiers who surrender, they're going to treat those soldiers like animals. So we lose the Philippine Islands in 1942. But towards the end of 42, we're going to see some success. We're going to start to see some momentum shifting in favor of the Allies at the Battle of Coral Sea. Now, Australia was their goal, Japan's goal, they being Japan. And they were marching towards Australia and then hopefully getting New Zealand as well. And they are met by a fleet of naval vessels there in the Coral Sea, and we hold them off, we beat them, we defeat them at the Battle of Coral Sea. And what this is going to do is not only prevent them from taking Japan, but it is going to deplete their vessels to the degree that they're really not going to be able to go on the offensive in the Pacific that much longer. That same year in 1942, we're going to have another decisive victory on the seas at the Battle of Midway. These are two pivotal moments in the Pacific theater during World War II. I want to discuss an important military strategy that is being incorporated in the Pacific theater, and that is known as the Island Hopping Campaign. This wasn't the original plan, but after the defeat at the Philippines, we realized that we're going to have to really think this thing through. We're not going to be able to take every island back that Japan has acquired through their imperial acquisition. We're going to have to be strategic. We're going to have to be calculated. And all we want to do with this island hopping campaign are take back the islands that strategically get us close enough to the mainland of Japan. And the man they have put in charge of this strategy is a name we've talked about before in this class. We talked about him in the early 20s. In the late 20s, with the Bonus Army March, is a man by the name of Douglas MacArthur. And Douglas MacArthur is a very controversial figure. He's a guy who loves himself some Douglas MacArthur. He is a guy who's very egotistical. He is a guy who does not take orders very well. We being FDR, the United States government ends up pulling him out of the Philippine Islands just before our troops surrender to Japan because they wanted to bring him back and have him head up this island hopping campaign. And so Douglas MacArthur will be charged with the task of slowly taking back strategic islands that would give us resources and air bases to attack Japan when the time came. In the European theater, we're going to see troops first begin fighting in North Africa. The French North Africa area is where we'll see a lot of presence. Guys like Patton will enter that area where they will eventually defeat Rommel in North Africa, giving them a straight shot at Italy. They're going to push them all the way back to the Tunisian Peninsula. Once we have them pushed back to the Tunisian Peninsula, we'll just have to get into Sicily, and then we can work our way up the mainland of Italy. And for most of 1943, we will have troops in Sicily fighting and trying to gain access to the mainland of Italy. Once we do that, Mussolini's days are numbered. Hitler eventually will try to, as the story goes, try to pull Mussolini out before it's too late. But Allied soldiers capture him before that time comes, and they end up executing Mussolini. In 1944, we will have the big D-Day invasion. This will be headed up by Dwight D. Eisenhower. An absolute bloodbath. And it's one of the hardest things to discuss as a historian because there's no way to encapsulate or describe accurately the amount of carnage that will take place in Normandy. eventually we will overwhelm the Germans at Normandy, and we will begin pushing back through France, liberating France completely, and then working our way into Germany. But for the purposes of this podcast, this is more of a podcast on Roosevelt, so I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on World War II itself, other than to say that this is a very stressful period for FDR. A wartime president, a Depression-era president, all combined into one. This is a man who has won 3 consecutive terms to this point in time, and now 1944 rolls around. On the heels of Normandy, and the Democrats are seeking Roosevelt's nomination in 44. And FDR will accept their nomination for a 4th term, but this time he's going to drop his vice president, who's had some issues, health issues, and he's going to add a man from Missouri. And the man that he's going to add to the ticket is a man that goes by the name of Harry S. Truman. No one really knows who he is. He's kind of a guy that's off the grid. But FDR's popularity is so high that he's not really concerned about Truman's effect on the ticket. FDR is easily going to defeat the Republican Thomas Dewey in 1944. And in his inauguration address, or his inaugural address rather, on January 20th, remember the 20th Amendment is going to set the date of January 20. So January 20th, 1945, remember you are elected in all even years. You take office the following odd. In his inaugural address, he will state, and I'm quoting from FDR, "In the days and in the years that are to come, we shall work for a just and honorable peace, a durable peace, as today we work and fight for total victory in war. We can and we will achieve such a peace." In February of 1945, a month into his 4th term, FDR is starting to look very old. He's starting to look very brittle, very weak. And for a long time, he's been able to hide that in various ways, raising the desks, steel-plated braces that keep him upright when he's giving a speech, but he is noticeably looking a lot older and much weaker. He looks sickly. But in February of 1945, he has a job to do. He's going to go meet with the big three. He is one of the big three. The other two are Winston Churchill and, of course, Joseph Stalin. And they're going to meet at the Yalta Conference in February of 1945 to sign off on a peacekeeping organization known as the United Nations. And if you think back to what we talked about at the conclusion of World War I, Wilson kind of had these same principles in mind. He wanted to create the League of Nations, a peacekeeping organization that would prevent another war like the Great War from ever happening again. But the problem for him was the Republican-controlled Senate did not want to lose their power to make decisions on war. And they feared that if they entered into an organization such as the League of Nations, they would lose that power, that they would be forced into helping countries in future conflicts. But as we have kind of seen things unfold as a result of us not entering into the League of Nations, by 1945, the tone has changed. Now, FDR and Churchill do not trust Stalin further than they can throw him. But they are hoping that they can convince Stalin to agree and follow through with the agreements that will be made at the Yalta Conference. While they are together, the three leaders will agree that the war will only end, and this is important, the war will only end with the unconditional surrender of the Axis powers. That was one of the mistakes made during World War I. They did not force the unconditional surrender of Germany. They allowed Germany to come to the table. They did allow them to surrender accept war reparations and the war guilt, but they let them off the hook and it kept the door cracked. That, combined with the lack of enforcement of the Treaty of Versailles, led to what we see in World War II. And the Big Three want to make sure that that does not happen again. At the Yalta Conference, Stalin will also agree to send troops to Asia to help the Allies against Japan. Now that Hitler, in May of 1945, commits suicide and Germany surrenders, the focus now turns to Japan. But in exchange for Stalin sending troops to Asia to assist the Allies, he was promised by FDR and Churchill that he would be able to regain the territory lost due to the Russo-Japanese War in 1904. And if you remember back to our podcast on Teddy Roosevelt was the president that brought that war to a close, won a Nobel Peace Prize for it. Very ugly war. But Stalin wants that territory lost as a part of that treaty. At the Yalta Conference, Stalin is also going to agree to allow free elections in Eastern Europe, including Poland, a promise that he would later back out on, and that's no surprise if you know Stalin. But as the conference concluded, the Big Three will also agree on what to do with the newly conquered Germany. They will agree to divide Germany into four zones, with France, Great Britain, the United States, and Russia splitting Germany up. On March 1st, 1945, FDR has returned home to discuss with Congress the results and the accomplishments at the Yalta Conference. And if he looked physically exhausted in February, he is looking worse by the time we get to March 1945. This is a man that has been through a lot in his presidency. He's overcome a lot as the President of the United States. He has guided the country through two of the most horrific eras in our country's history, and that is the Great Depression and now World War II. And it's taking a toll on his body, and it's making his polio worse. The symptoms of the polio are magnified because of the stress that he is going through due to the job. After he discusses the findings at the Yalta Conference, or the agreements rather, at the Yalta Conference, he's going to check in with his doctors because he's just feeling so exhausted. And the doctors are going to check him out and they're going to say, you know, you need to slow down. But he doesn't have time to slow down as President of the United States at the apex of World War II. And because he continues to try to work through these issues and try to find a way to finish the war in the Pacific, a month later on April 12, 1945, Franklin Delano Roosevelt dies. And the country is in absolute shock. This is a man who has been the leader of their country since 1933. He has led them through the Great Depression. He has led them almost through the completion of World War II. And now that we reach the most crucial point in World War II, where we've got to make a decision, on what to do with the Empire of Japan. The island hopping campaign is successful. And now you're right there at the finish line. and the 32nd President of the United States passes away. And what makes the anxiety level even greater for the American people is that the Vice President of the United States is now promoted to the presidency, a guy who most Americans could not pick out of a lineup. Harry S. Truman from Missouri. And that's where we'll pick up next time. I hope that you've enjoyed the podcast. I hope that you learn something, even if it's just one item, one little nugget you can take away. As always, guys, please like the podcast, or, you know, hate it if you want. I don't care. But leave us some feedback. Anytime that you can give us a rating or leave us some feedback, it helps us and it helps spread our podcast around. If you know of anybody that's in U.S. history that might could use this as a tutorial, please help them out by sharing this with them. And as always, guys, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. See you next time.